From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, there's an open line for you now at 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, along with our interesting callers, some interesting topics to talk about.
Yes, aircraft noise and heart disease, noise pollution. Interesting research published in the British Medical Journal that I think is going to open your eyes.
Yeah, sounds interesting. What else?
Exercise. Good study that shows that it may be as effective in heart disease as taking statins. We'll talk about that and talk about whether or not you should stop your pills or not stop your pills and what this means for you if you're at risk for heart disease.
Coming up, and our recipe.
Dynamite. Mushroom and greens panini. I love panini. I happen to love mushrooms, greens. It's a good vegetarian recipe that I think even you, Tom, the carnivore of this pair, yeah, will love.
Well, I know what mushrooms are, but I'll find out what panini is when we get, when
yes,
we get to
will.
The recipe.
Yes, you will.
800-462-7413. It's toll-free, 800-462-7413. Now to the phone, Zorba, and a listener in Maxville, Kansas. Hi.
Hi, Zorba.
How can we help?
I had a question for the doctor. I generally sleep realistically about between 4 and 4.5 hours a day, a night. I've always been real active, and I'm in really good health, and I must go right into REM sleep. Does he have any comments about it?
Well, how long has this been going on forever that you've only had?
I'm 52 years old, and it's been my whole life. I've been real active. I've always did real hard physical work, and I just don't sleep that much.
Let me ask you this. When do you sleep those 4 hours? When do you go to bed and when do you wake up?
I generally go to bed about midnight or 11 o'clock, and I usually get up about 3 or 4, and I hardly ever sleep over 5 hours.
Very interesting. So now, do you nap during the daytime at all?
Absolutely not. I'm very active.
So you're active, like you say, it's a physical job. I just finished a book, The Age of Electricity, which was about Thomas Edison. And he always said he slept 3 or 4 hours a night, which he did. But he also slept in his lab several hours a day, according to other people in his lab. And I find this interesting. There's a genetic predisposition to sleep. I have a very good friend, Larry, the only high school friend I still have left. The others have left the coop, as the term is. But he only gets about 4 to 5 hours of sleep. But he finds himself also sleepy during the day. His uncle, who is Hyman Rickover, father of the nuclear Navy, also only needed about 4 to 5 hours of sleep. And my office partner, one of my partners in my medical practice, only needs about 5 hours of sleep because he goes to sleep like that. So I am convinced that some people clearly need less sleep. I need about 8 to 9. My wife needs about 6 to 7 hours of sleep. And you're just at the low end of the curve. And Tom brought up a good point. This has been going on your whole life and you haven't suffered, right?
No, I have no ill effects at all. I've chosen jobs that are ridiculously physical. Uh-huh. And I've had no adverse, just sleep 4 hours a night, and I'm fine.
Uh-huh. Well, I think that's perfectly fine. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. And like you said, you must go into REM sleep right away. As long as you feel good and you've been doing it for a long time, I think I would keep up what you're doing. And the fact is, as you get older, you might find that your sleep becomes more fragmented. That's what happens as we get older. But you've got a habit. It works out. It's not going to cause you any side effects. Sleep is really important. I always tell people you really need 8 to 9 hours. But like all advice we doctors give, we have to even individualize it. So keep it up. You're not doing yourself any harm at all. You know, one of the interesting things are we make general recommendations, and they're good, but they're general recommendations, and you've got to individualize it. So from a sleep point of view, 6 to 7 for some people is just fine. For other people, it's 8 to 9 hours. I mean, the other day, I slept for 11 hours. Well, my wife hasn't slept for 11 hours forever, it seems. And for me, that was the right amount. Yeah, and you don't need – how much sleep do you get?
Well, I used to sleep for about 6 hours, but I would nap in the afternoon. Uh-huh. And, now I do 7-8 hours anyway.
Uh-huh. And you don't nap in the afternoon?
No.
No, see. You know, we as a society brag about lack of sleep. Oh, I didn't get much sleep here and there. The reality is sleep is important to us. But for this guy, 4.5 hours, perfect.
Well, we both have to stay awake for the next 53 minutes.
I guess we do.
1-800-462-7413. It's toll free. And a Norman, Oklahoma listener joins in now. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
Well, I have a 10-year-old son. He's in grade 5 this year. And he has been, over the past few weeks, waking up in the middle of the night, I would say somewhere between 2 and 3 a.m., sometimes as late as 4. And this is almost a nightly occurrence now. He also, this year, has been having some mathematics sort of related stuff that I've become aware of.
What do you mean? What do you mean by mathematic related?
Well, like in his grade level, this is the year when they're going to be doing some testing, and the teacher has made it known to the kids that this is kind of a big year. And I think because he didn't get those times tables memorized last year, this has kind of, I think, become an anxiety-inducing issue for him. Mm-hmm. On occasion, I've heard him actually cry out, maybe sounding like he was having a nightmare or something, as if he were in pain, possibly. Uh-huh. And one time I know he did say that he was feeling like he was having chest pains. Now, it wasn't near the heart region.
Yeah.
It was more over to the left side below.
Yeah, the chances that your 10-year-old boy has any heart disease is pretty minimal. You know, usually at that age, if you're going to have any sort of heart disease, he's not going to grow properly. He's not going to run around. Doctor is going to pick up a murmur. Is he normal in terms of growing and exercise?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, very active and tall for his age.
Yeah.
As far as
I mean, he would be – there would be issues. You know, you would see it physiologically. Let's go to the math. Mm-hmm. Multiplication tables are difficult. I mean, they're hard. You got to memorize them. That's the way it goes. Otherwise, you can't do them quickly enough. Do you have flashcards for him?
Oh, yeah. We've got the whole – it's just his lack of application, personal – time. He doesn't want to spend time learning.
This is one of those quality family things where really you can develop things with him, where you develop a relationship with him in all seriousness that will then help him. Because you got to memorize these tables. You got to do it. It's important in school, and it's important in life. And seriously, what happens is when we sit down, we don't use them often with a calculator, but we have to know how to use them when we're estimating. And so, and it's critical. And a lot of kids don't know their multiplication tables. And I think he's waking up with anxiety. I think that's just what it is.
I do too.
Have you talked to him about this?
Oh, yeah. And I notice in the family, we all, in times of stress, exhibit what I see as anxiety-related things.
Sure.
Let me ask you one other thing, because I just came across something that's new to me. It's called glycine, an amino acid that's supposed to help with sleep, and that tends to be the first area that I notice with all of us that sleep will be affected. What do you think about?
I don't. That? I'm not for kids going on something for sleep. In other words, I don't think it's a good idea for adults using natural remedies because our sleep is more fragmented as we get older. But for kids, it's just not a good idea. I think you hit it right on the head. Attend to the issue there. And you also hit on the head that he doesn't want to do it. Well, it may be a time issue. So you say, look, we're going to do it for 10 minutes here, 10 minutes here, 10 minutes there. In other words, and that means study habits, maybe going to the school, talking to the school psychologist and talking to the teacher and saying, what sort of things? Because he's in the grade where they have – he's 10, did you say?
Right.
10 years. So generally, 10-year-olds have about 10 minutes of an attention span. That's about what it is. It's about a minute per year of age. That's how I think of it. So you're going to want to do 10 minutes here and 10 minutes there. And the fact is, when he masters those multiplication tables, he is going to feel so good that he's going to sleep through the night and say, thanks, Mom. You helped me.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Enjoy the show.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks. Appreciate the call. 1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And Zorba, let's talk now about a topic you mentioned at the top of the show, aircraft noise and heart disease.
Fascinating article in the British Medical Journal. Just fascinating. So, you know, we talk about air pollution all the time. We've gotten rid of smoke in the environment. Who would have thunk that almost every state in the union, you can't smoke in public places, including bars? If somebody told me in Wisconsin that the taverns would be smoke-free, if they told me that 10 years ago, I would say you're crazy. Maybe the restaurants, but, you know, not the taverns. So we've recognized that air pollution is something that we all want to be without. But we don't think about noise pollution, and especially noise pollution that occurs in big cities. So this particular article looked at aircraft noise. In other words, people living near the airport where they have 10 decibels, 15 decibels of noise. And a little side note here. I live, come from Chicago and brought a number of kids home from college, and we're in the house, and they said, how can you stand that? And I said, what? Well, we were on a flyway to O'Hare. And, you know, we talked, and when the plane went over, I guess we stopped talking if it was too noisy. And I had never noticed it because it was just the way it was. And they said, doesn't that bother you? And I said, bother me. And I hadn't noticed it. And after they told me, of course, I noticed it a lot. Yeah. But they looked at people in London's Heathrow Airport. There are about 4 million people that are living right around the airport. And they found that the incidence of stroke, heart disease, and other cardiovascular disease among that population was significantly increased compared to the population just outside of that noise zone. And then they looked and they said, okay, well, are there more males or females? What about ethnicity? What about social deprivation?
There are a lot of variables other than the noise.
Right. But there, it turned out there weren't just poor neighborhoods. There also went over middle-class neighborhoods and wealthier neighborhoods. Same thing. Risk of cardiovascular disease. And a lot of the people around Heathrow are of South Asian descendants. And they actually have less heart disease than the Brits, you know, genetically.
Yeah.
So then – In a corollary, in another study, they looked at other airports with zip codes in the U.S. that were near airports. And lo and behold, they found a higher incidence of in the United States of cardiovascular disease, about 3 to 4% more of people living near airports.
You think about it, it kind of makes sense because if you're under stress a whole lot, and you're under stress if there's noise all the time.
That's right. Then the next thing they did is they started to look at daytime-nighttime issues. So in other words, during the daytime, we expect more noise. During the nighttime when we're relaxing or trying to go to sleep, we expect less noise. And that might be where the biggest bang for the buck is. It might be that airports that allow planes to come in until midnight, so their flyovers are actually disrupting the sleep of the people who are there, because we know sleep. We know that when you wake up, for instance, you're at a higher risk for heart attacks. We know that in the morning, from 6 to 9 in the morning, there are more heart attacks than for, say, 6 to 9 in the evening. So it may be that this is actually a sleep disturbance issue, and it may be that airports that are open at night with lots of planes are causing the problems.
They don't tend to be, do they?
Well, they don't tend to around here. They have a limit on there, but there are fewer flights at nighttime. Yeah. Well, they started limiting. They used to have flights that went on 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and they started limiting that because people didn't like it. It may turn out that's where the issue is. We need more research on it, but I find it fascinating that this may be an example of noise pollution that may be the next step in helping our society become a better society.
Interesting stuff. 1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number, and a Buffalo, New York listener with us now. Hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine. How can we help?
Well, I'm 31 years old, and I was recently in April diagnosed with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. And
I'm sorry, with what?
Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. It's an inherited genetic connective tissue disorder. And it was hard enough to receive a diagnosis. And at this point, I'm finding it difficult to find resources to help myself feel better or help find ways to manage the disease. And that will be my question today is, where is the resources for this?
Yes, we've been doing this show a long time, Zorba, and I don't recall an Ehlers-Danlos syndrome question coming up.
It's a syndrome that I know minimally about. Tell me about it. When did it start?
It's something I've had my entire life, symptoms. However,
what sort of symptoms were you having?
When I was a child, I used to complain of growing pains. When I slept, I remember getting MRIs when I was a child. And then finding nothing wrong with me. However, as a kid, I would still complain of pain. And as I approached you know, got into my 20s and approached my 30s, my health started to decline greatly, mm-hmm. and I sort of followed my heart that something was wrong, and I eventually reached my diagnosis despite, you know, other tests for autoimmune diseases and things like that coming back negative. Mm-hmm. I sort of took a look at my family, and a younger cousin of mine has it. So she got diagnosed before me mm-hmm. a few years back. So
I know minimal about this, but I can give you some advice on what I would do in terms of resources. You know, a lot of diseases, by the way, especially rare and unusual diseases, we don't think about. In other words, because, you know, when we're our diagnosticians, we look for things that are common or things that have certain symptoms that we can look at that are unusual. And a whole bunch of diseases fall into this middle way sort of situation. One of the things that I would do is you want to find out who the experts are, and then you want to find out what your insurance company will pay for a second opinion. So insurance companies have to make sure that they have the resources to be able to give you the best medical care that there is. So you want to find out within your panel or your HMO panel or your insurance, who is the authority with this? And the place to start with that often is with rheumatology. And if they don't have anyone in rheumatology who's an expert, you then have to say, I want to get a second opinion outside the panel. And the way to do that is to go in Buffalo. You've got a great medical school, and they'll have someone who will know something about the syndrome. Where are you going right now?
I was diagnosed by a geneticist, mm-hmm. and then my primary care doctor mm-hmm. never heard, well, they heard of it, but they didn't quite know how right. to care for a patient with it. But I actually found a doctor who's out in the country mm-hmm. whose patients do have it. Mm-hmm. So they know how to treat individuals with it because uh-huh. it affects, it's connective tissue, it's the glue of your body.
Right, right. So have you gone there?
Oh, yes. I started seeing him, good. And it's sort of a slow process. Mm-hmm. But as far as how do I manage all other aspects of it, and even looking to my future, it, you know, if I choose to have children, how does this affect a pregnancy? What happens when I get older?
Right. So what you want to do, just to sort of bird dog this, because I don't have those answers for you here, but what you want to do is look at who is an expert nationally on this that you might be able to go and see and get an opinion. And then you have to talk to your insurance people and say, this is somebody who's an expert in this. If you don't have anyone within my panel who's an expert, I want to get a second opinion to go somewhere. Because this is a good example of an ongoing syndrome. As I said, I have minimal knowledge of this, but I have maximal knowledge of how to find out who in your area would be someone who's useful. And again, the issue is you found a doctor who knows about it. It's not going to be your primary care doctor, because it's a rare thing. The geneticist is also often a good resource, but we'll look at that and see if we can get you some help for it. So thank you. Thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
Yep. 800-462-7413.
I think in this age of Google, something like this is really useful. You can look at it. But this is where I think you often need to have a mentor. You need to have somebody who's an advocate for you, because you can't just, as a consumer of medical care, find that. But often, if you've got a good primary care doc or somebody else who sort of knows what's going on, they can find somebody in your area or within a couple of hundred miles who has expertise with that. And if it's extremely rare, that's where sites like Mayo Clinic and the Cleveland Clinic become really, really important.
And before we take a quick break, Zorba, let's take care of a little Zorba Pastor on Your Health police business.
Ooh, I love it.
Today, Zorba is taken to task by the Pepper Police. All the way across the pond in France. On our Facebook page, Antoine writes, "Hi, Zorba and Tom. In a recent show, you seemed to not be sure of the difference between red, yellow, and green peppers. It's really a difference of maturity. Every pepper, mild or hot, turns red at full maturity. The color difference is due to the time the pepper takes to turn red. Some begin green, then turn yellow, and then finally red. The various color sequences can also be green to purple to red, green to orange to red, or simply green to red. In other words, you can have almost a full rainbow of peppers in your cooking arsenal. Thank you for the show, Antoine, a vegetable farmer in France.
I love it. We've reached vegetable farming in France. I had no idea that that you're basically looking at the same pepper in various levels of of maturity. So that's wonderful to know. And the red ones I always find taste a little sweeter than the green ones. But, of course, they're more in maturity. They must produce more carbohydrate or some more sweetness. Yeah. I love it. Thank you, Antoine. And so wonderful to actually know that someone in France who's a vegetable farmer is listening to us. Way to go!
Great. Do you take issue with Zorba's lack of maturity? Join the Zorba.
You know, I've been accused of lack of maturity, but not based on my peppers.
Join the Zorba Pastor on your health police force and pass along your wisdom by sending an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
A recipe is coming up. Lots more of your calls, of course. Some more interesting research to talk over, our medical myth buster. A plethora of good things right here on Zorba Pastor on your health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again, 800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. But before we get back to the phones, Zorba, our recipe for mushroom and greens panini. What is panini?
Well, panini are those sandwiches that are, you know, have a they're sort of like a flatbread and they're pushed down and they are flatbread sandwiches made on a grill.
Is that like the kind of sandwich where you can't eat it without stuff falling out all over the place?
Yeah, that's the sandwich. That's exactly it. That's, you got it.
Okay.
That's exactly what.
Okay.
Why do you think the Earl of Sandwich said it should be in bread? Because it soaks it up. But with panini, you're slob. Yeah. We could call this the sandwich of slobs. That's exactly. You're eating it and the stuff is coming out.
Okay.
And you're trying to look really good. You know, and I have to tell you, I was recently at a fundraiser. And when you're at a fundraiser, you're sitting with other people and everyone's kind of dressed up. And I've got a salad there with all these kinds of greens and salad dressing. And I'm trying to stuff the salad into my mouth in as delicate a way as possible. And I'm not doing a very good job. So I looked around the whole table and I noticed the women who are sitting there, they have a little knife and they're pushing it down with the knife. And they're trying to get, you know, trying to get everything just perfectly so they can put it in their mouth without putting it all over their mouth.
Yeah.
You know, and we're all, it's a failure. It's a failure. We're all failing. And panini is similar. You know, eat a panini and you might as well just put on new clothes.
Okay, well.
Actually, I think we need to invent panini bibs. That would be a good idea. So you wear a bib on it.
That says Zorba Pastor.
You got it. I'm going to make big bucks. Maybe in gold lame. That's another story. Gold lame bib.
Okay.
My Aunt Sylvia.
Let's do
God
this
bless
recipe.
Her. I'm stuck on the bib. Okay.
Okay.
Mushroom and greens panini. Yeah. So start out with fresh washed greens, kale, chard, turnip greens, your favorite greens. So you pick a green that you like.
Okay.
Portobello mushrooms, one medium portobello mushroom sliced 1 inch thick.
A medium portobello mushroom sliced 1/2 inch thick.
2 tablespoonfuls of extra virgin olive oil.
2 big tea olive oil.
Clove of garlic.
Clove of garlic.
Now, you love garlic. I love garlic.
Yeah.
Would you really just use a clove?
I don't know, because I never know how much is there.
When it
there.
Comes to garlic, you can never have too much garlic.
Yeah,
so
I think that's right.
A dash of salt. I would use kosher salt or sea salt.
Dash of salt.
Dash of freshly ground pepper.
Dash of freshly ground pepper.
Ounce of Gruyere cheese or maybe Gruyere and some sliced Parmesan. You could use Swiss, but Swiss doesn't have the same robustness.
I like a lot of the cheeses. I didn't realize that until I got really old.
Try Gruyere. That you like cheese.
I used to eat cheddar, and now I really like a whole bunch of them.
Have you ever tried 10-year-old cheddar that you can get at the farmer's market?
Yeah, isn't that good?
To die. Yeah. 4 slices of whole grain bread.
4 slices whole grain bread.
So, like I said, I think of it as a flatbread, but the paninis, you can also use a flatbread in there if you want to.
Mm-hmm.
And a good whole grain bread will work, but I would tend to use a flatbread. But either one of them are fine. Okay. So, bring a pot of water to a boil. You can do that, Tom. You can bring a pot of water to a boil.
You have to know how to turn the stove on.
You can do it. I have faith and your ability to boil water. Okay. That's it. Fill a boil with fill a bowl, another bowl with ice water. You can do that.
Okay,
Tom.
So far,
I
so
have
good.
Faith. So far, so good. When the water comes to a boil, put the salt in it. Salt it generously and add the greens. You can do this. Mm-hmm. All you do is add the greens into the water. Then bring the water back to a boil just for 2 to 3 minutes, and then put them immediately into cold ice water. So what you're doing is you're blanching them. Okay, and you want to put it in cold ice water to stop the cooking process, mm-hmm. so it's going to blanch them. That's kind of similar to what we do when we heat up greens when we saute them. We're just using heat, but in this case, it's a liquid heat. And then what I would do is I would put it in a colander and then push it with a couple of paper towels to get out the excess water, mm-hmm. so they've been slightly cooked. Then take the panini grill. Do you own a panini grill? Next question. Take a panini grill that you got for Christmas or for your wedding. Now, when we got married, we had not one, not two, but we got 3 fondue grills.
Go away.
Because that
oh,
was
yeah,
what you got.
Oh, yeah, fondue was the big thing.
That's what you got.
Yeah.
So let's
you're
see.
Dating
let's
yourself
see.
There.
How many panini do you do? I wonder if the guys in the peanut gallery back there, if they got panini grills for their wedding. Let's see there. Yeah, you see? They got a panini
do
grill.
Do they even know what fondue is?
Yeah, they know what fondue is. They know what fondue is. So you see, panini is the new fondue, right? Like orange is the new black. Anyway, but panini grills, commonly used wedding gift. Brush the both sides of the mushroom slices with olive oil and grill the mushrooms for 1 or 2 minutes. You're going to use that grill. Don't throw it away. You can use the grill.
Okay.
3 fondue. I can't believe it. Okay. Season it with desire, a little salt if you want to, or some garlic salt. Then heat another tablespoon of olive oil in a medium skillet over medium heat. Saute the garlic for about 30 seconds until it's fragrant. Stir in the greens. Toss to coat. Season with salt and pepper and remove it. Keep the greens so that they're firm. Now, sprinkle half the cheese, this is the Gruyere cheese, over the bread slices. Top the cheese with a few mushroom slices. Then put the greens on top of them. Press them down with the back of the spoon. Then top the greens with the remaining cheese. So you're going to layer it. That's what you're doing. Cover it with the remaining bread. Brush the outside of the bread with a little olive oil. Put it in the panini maker and grill it for 3 to 5 minutes till the cheese is melted and the bread is toasty. It may seem like a lot, but what you're actually doing is layering greens, cheese. You're putting nice whole wheat bread or flat bread on there, whichever bread you want to have on there. And then you're basically toasting it with both sides. It's delicious. It's about 400 calories. Most of that calorie is coming from olive oil, which is good, and some of the calories coming from cheese, which in moderate amounts is also good for you. It's got some fiber in it. It tastes good. And besides that, you can finally use that wedding gift that you have in the basement to make some good food.
Now, if I would like a copy of this recipe, what do I do?
I have a really good way that you can get it from your smartphone or from the website. You go to zorbapastor.org. You can find this recipe. You can find all the other recipes on there. You can sign up for our podcast, and you can look at Tom's photo, which is on it, on the grill. That's zorbapastor.org, and you're smiling. You're smiling because you
got
like
a photo of me eating that
That's
panini
right.
thing.
I know we don't have the photo of you eating the panini. We don't have the photo. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook and iTweet.
1-800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. And back to the phones we go now, Zorba, with a listener in Ada, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Fine. How can we help?
I have a problem. My wife has been diagnosed with what's called a chronic cough. And she coughs like she smokes 3 packs a day. She doesn't smoke at all. Hmm. Hasn't been around it, but it sounds like I'm in bed with a barking seal. So, and we've been to like literally 7 different doctors, and they've done MRIs, they've done CAT scans, and they can't find anything. But she coughs till she almost throws up sometimes, and it's just really horrible.
Wow. How long has this been going on?
For a couple of years, and we can't, it won't stop.
Wow. She's not, she on any medications at all?
Tessinex pearls is what she takes.
Uh-huh. Is she on a blood pressure pill?
No, sir.
Okay. The reason I ask is ACE inhibitors. There are a number of pills that are called ACE inhibitors, and they produce a dry cough, and that's a side effect. So she's not on blood pressure pills. She's on Tessalon pearls, which is a non-narcotic drug that we give for a chronic cough. A history of asthma at all?
No, sir. None at all.
Has she tried a steroid inhaler, such as a Flovent inhaler?
Yes, sir. She's tried. They've prescribed her several things, some steroids, inhalers, different things, and it just doesn't seem to knock it out. Some of them will slow it down, and then it comes right back.
And this is a sensation that she has all the time. What is she? Has she been on hydrocodone, which is a codeine-type preparation to reduce the cough sensitivity?
I think she has. At one time, she's tried numerous things that the doctors have given her, and does sound familiar. But it, when the medicine runs out, some of it, like I had said, some of it slows it down, but none of it actually stops it. It just can't seem to knock it out.
Has she gone to a neurologist and been on medications for a tic, T-I-C?
I'm not familiar with that one, no, sir.
Okay, so let me give you an idea of where to go. You've obviously had the full pulmonary workup. You've had MRIs.
Yes.
She doesn't
right.
have asthma. You've gone to ENT docs, I assume, ear, nose, and throat doctors. They've looked at her, the back of her throat and everything. I mean, I'm making a lot of assumptions here, but she's had MRIs. She's looked at it. But you haven't gone the neurological route.
No.
Now, let me explain what this might be. There's something called Tic de la Rue. Now, tic de la rue is where people have all of a sudden they'll be in the middle of a conversation, for instance, and they'll swear. And they don't want to say the word, but it's called a verbal tic. Mm-hmm. And it's where neurologically things come out. It's not a seizure, but it's a neurological complication that occurs. And it can be very disturbing because all of a sudden you're
talking. Is that like Tourette's?
It's like Tourette's, yeah. Tourette's, tic de la rue and Tourette's.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that.
And so she may have a variation of that. And it may not be physiologically based on the back of her throat. It may not be based on her lungs. And it may not be based on the sensation. But she might have a tic like Tourette's. Then instead of being a verbal tic, it's a tic that is telling her to cough.
Hmm.
And I would go the neurological route and look upon medications that are used for tic de la rue and Tourette syndrome, which can be very effective. And medications that are also used for obsessive compulsive disorders, certain types of antidepressants, and that's where I would send her. I'd look at a neurologist. I think what you're describing might not be based on a sensation in the back of her throat, but something in her brain that is telling her that there's a sensation in the back of her throat that's making her cough. And you haven't gone that route. That's what I would suggest.
Tic de la rue, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
She needs a neurologist to see if this, instead of being is a verbal tic, that this is actually a tic that is producing the sensation of coughing, and that what we have to do then is work on medications that stop that syndrome from happening, and they can be very effective with training and medications, just like the verbal tics of Tourette's, where people stop swearing, they actually stop through a combination of medications and training. She needs a combination of behavioral therapy and medications for her to be able to stop dealing with the sensation from a neurological and psychological point of view. That's what I would suggest, given the complete workup that you've had.
All right. Well, Zorba, thank you very much. And, Tom, I'll talk to you guys later.
Oh, great. Thanks so much.
Thanks for
your call. Appreciate the call at 800-462-7413. And before we take a quick break, Zorba, let's take an email question from a concerned listener named Lois. She writes, "Dear Dr. Zorba, I have a problem with a terrible smell in my nose. It smells something like stale coffee or stale perfume, and it is there 24/7, even making it hard to fall asleep at night. In addition, smells are distorted, making things smell differently than they really do. Along with the smell problem is an increasing distortion of taste and a burning tongue. I've had all these problems in the past. The smell problem is about 3 years old and the burning tongue about 5 years ago. I sought diagnosis and treatment for both, but nothing worked until they eventually just went away. But now they are back. Do you have any suggestions?"
You mean the doctors went away?
No. The symptoms.
Well, diagnostic dilemma. That's what I would first say. Yeah. First thing we do is look for infections. We look for polyps in the back of the nose, chronic sinus infections that either can be within the nose or up in the sinuses. Yeah, that's kind of the first thing.
3 or 5 years ago.
Well, we look for that. Second thing we do often is put steroids in the nose and see whether or not a steroid spray in the nose will open things up. But infections often cause this. Sometimes, believe it or not, the food we eat can cause it. There was a pine nut. Interesting things about people who ate pine nuts that came from China versus from Italy that then had distorted taste for about 3 to 6 months. And this occurred due to some sort of a preservative that was used in the Chinese pine nuts. And it was a big issue, very big issue. So food can make a change in sensation. Now that I've said those three things, I do not have the foggiest idea what actually caused it.
3 to 5 years, that's a lot of long
time. That's a lot of stuff. And it went away, and I've no idea why it went away. And so this is one of the stump the doctors that you have simply stumped me. But once again, it's infections and other things that tend to cause the problem.
Where should she go now?
ENT doc, look in the back of the nose, see what's going on. That's what I would recommend, because that's usually where you get bang for your buck.
Have a problem for Zorba to sniff out? Just send your questions along in an email.
Or to stump.
Yes.
Zorba at WPR. I'm going to enunciate ORG.
Some interesting research to kick around. We'll do that right away. Then more of your questions and our medical MythBuster later on here on Zorba Pastor and Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. To the phones we go in just a bit at 1-800-462-7413. But before that, Zorba, exercise as a substitute for drugs?
Well, fascinating study. It was looking at exercise in terms of how it actually prevented heart attacks from occurring, strokes and so on. So this was a study of studies. It's called a mega study. Researchers looked at over 300 randomized controlled studies. Okay, so they're good studies. A total of 330,000 people in terms. Okay, so they're mixing all these studies together. Mm-hmm. And they looked at studies that had people engaging in exercise or no exercise, to see whether or not that would make a difference. Keep in mind that, that if you look at it, the majority of people in America do not exercise. And they were looking at people in England who only 17% of the people exercise on a regular basis. And here's what they found. When it came to, there's primary prevention, secondary prevention. Primary prevention is I don't get the heart attack in the first place. Secondary prevention is I've had a heart attack, I don't want to get a second one. Or I've got high cholesterol and I don't want to get a heart attack, but I've had a stent put in. That's called secondary prevention. And that's easier to measure than primary. People who engaged in regular exercise turned out to reduce their risk of a second heart attack equal to whether or not they took Lipitor. In other words, you take Lipitor when you have high cholesterol and you have a heart attack, and it turned out the people who exercised did just as well as the people who were on statins. When it came to a stroke, it turned out that exercise was more important than being on Plavix, aspirin, or Coumadin. In other words, it was actually getting a second stroke. Exercise counted even more than the drug itself.
But now, does exercise reduce cholesterol?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. So, and then let me go to the third thing. Heart failure, turns out the drugs were more important than exercise. So let's look at what we're looking at.
Yeah.
The only reason we care about cholesterol and high blood pressure is because we want to reduce heart attack and stroke.
Sure.
Who cares about the numbers? We care about whether or not we have the disease. The important thing about this study is that it showed exercise actually plays a more important role than we ever thought. Now, the study didn't answer the question of how about statins plus exercise?
Mm-hmm.
It couldn't answer that from the study of studies.
Well, but now I take a statin. and I do some exercise, mm-hmm. should I just stop taking the statin?
No, not at all. And in fact, I think the bottom line of the study is don't give up the statin, because we know the statins are very effective for a variety of reasons. But the study shows that exercise is a booster. And for those people who cannot tolerate statins, and that's about 10 to 15% of the population, exercise is then the panacea for them. So no, don't give up your statin, but get off your Duff. Very important.
1-800-462-7413. And a listener now, Zorba in El Paso, Texas. Hi.
Hi. Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's up?
My question is related to the topic of parasites. We have a pet that lives inside the house, and my son is a 15-year-old boy, and he has a lot of contact with the dog. They play a lot. She will just go up to his lap or jump up on his bed, and they have a lot of contact. So my question is, how feasible is that? And we treat the dog for parasites every month, but how feasible is that the dog could transmit parasites to the family? And then on the topic of diagnosis for parasites, treatments for parasites, what kind of things I'm looking at?
Oh, sure. It's interesting. We've co-evolved with dogs. And, you know, they lick us on the face, you know, if we get close to them, as most dog owners are. And so this has been a common question as to whether or not dogs can actually transmit parasites to us. And it's remarkably minimal. In other words, it's almost non-existent where the parasites that affect dogs actually affect humans, because we often treat our animals for common parasites that can actually be transmitted to humans. Mm-hmm. So you've got your dog in your house, as I have a dog in my house, and as Tom has a dog in his house. Mm-hmm. And, the chances the dogs are going to transmit any parasite to anybody in your family are pretty much minimal, hardly exists at all. Now, how can you tell? Well, you do a stool test to tell. The most common things that we look for in terms of parasites are Giardia. That's a common parasite that can be done with a very simple stool test. Cryptosporidium, there's some others. If you're concerned, you get a stool test. They can look for what's called ova in parasites, to look for roundworm, which is a common parasite when you're traveling from a foreign country. So a stool test is the simple answer on how you find it. And we usually don't do it unless we're symptomatic. Mm-hmm. But I have lots of patients with dogs. I have a country practice in a small town outside of Madison. I don't remember ever in my entire practice, and I've been practicing for 75 years, I don't remember ever in my entire practice seen anyone who had a dog that transmitted a parasite. So it's a very, very rare event, and I wouldn't be concerned about it. Anyone in your house have symptoms, diarrhea at all? Or?
Well, he's been complaining a little bit about stomach problems and aches, and he hasn't been as regular. His eating habits are mm-hmm. not so good right now. And how effective are those just over-the-counter treatments like cleanse, parasite, and those type of things, are they good, like those natural remedies?
Yeah, I think they're pretty worthless. They don't produce anything. If you have a parasite in your body, we diagnose the parasite, but we have good common medications that actually get rid of parasites that are dynamite.
Does what he describes sound like a parasite problem to you?
No, I don't think it's a parasite problem. No, I think he's just a kid with abdominal problems, and we have to figure out what that is. You know, a child that has those problems, that his chances of parasite are pretty remote. And then what we do often in our office, if we can't figure out, is we do check for parasites. And if we find them, then we have to find out where they come from. And they're not usually the dog. They're usually from daycare or other humans that have it. But I wouldn't give any of those over-the-counter remedies. I don't think they're effective, and I think you would have a waste of money. But if he continues to have any kind of diarrhea, illness, or abdominal pain, I'd go to the doc and try to find out what it is. A food intolerance, such as a lactose or milk intolerance, is the most common cause for abdominal bloating, abdominal pain, diarrhea, constipation, lack of appetite. It often is, you know, dairy products are the number one culprit.
Okay.
Good luck. Okay. Let us know
Thank
what
you.
Happens. You're yep. welcome. You're
Appreciate
welcome.
The call. Thank you very much. 800-462-7413. Time again now, Zorba, to dive into our medical myth buster. And this one you can answer in one word.
You really? Wait a second. One word?
One word.
So you're limiting me to one word?
No, you can use, you will.
I can
you,
use you'll, more you'll than use, one word?
You'll use a whole thank lot you. Of paragraphs.
Thank you. You could with do one it word, I would fail.
You always hear that you're supposed to wait 30 minutes after eating before going swimming, or else you'll cramp up, creating a dangerous situation for yourself. Is this really the case?
I'm going to use one word, you know.
And you already that didn't use one word.
No.
Have a myth floating around that you'd like Zorba to wade through? Send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org or send us a message on Facebook. We're all over Facebook.
Again, 800-462-7413, toll free. And now Zorba, a listener in Vernon County, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. How can we help?
Well, about 6 weeks ago, I noticed that regardless of what I ate, I had a minty taste in my mouth. I've even eaten a raw garlic clove, and afterwards it tasted minty. My husband tells me that my breath is not, in fact, minty. About the same time, I had a corresponding numbness on the tip of my tongue. It actually started about a week later. They were all the time. Now they're kind of intermittent.
And how long has this gone on for?
About 6 weeks.
Any viral illnesses or anything else that's occurred?
Nope. In the last 2 days, I've had a cold, but
before
didn't
that,
have the
nothing.
Cold prior to that.
Allergies at all? Sinus problems at all?
No.
Uh-huh. Have you taken any medications for this at all?
I'm not on any meds, no.
Okay.
I did try an antacid because someone went online and said that there's something called silent reflux, but uh-huh. That's didn't do anything.
Uh-huh. Silent reflux. Mm. I mean, there is silent reflux, but I've never heard it said in that way, but that's true. You can get reflux without having the symptoms of reflux, and it can cause a chronic cough and hoarseness.
But does this bother you? Mm-hmm. I kind of think I might like mm-hmm. having a minty taste.
Well, it depends if you like mint.
Well, it's 6 weeks now.
It's six
you know,
sick
there's
of
nothing better than a glass of red wine and chocolate, but then the aftertaste is mint. Kind of ruins it.
You can get sick of anything, I guess.
Or steak and the aftertaste of mint, you know. Yeah. Or you go out for Chinese food or pad thai and the aftertaste.
Yeah.
I could see how you would get that.
Yeah,
I can
too,
any taste. Back to work.
Yeah.
Back to work. What I would suggest that you do is you call your doc and you try a steroid nasal inhaler. And see whether or not there's some sort of inflammatory process in the back of the throat and in the back of the tongue that is causing, you know, your brain to smell mint. It's clear the mint is not there to smell, but you must have some inflammatory response. Why it happened, I have no idea.
Before it happened, I was playing soccer, and I did head the ball a couple times in that game. Could that have done something?
Yeah, could have done something with that. Well, first of all, you know, when you – wait a second. How old are you?
46.
It was hard for you to
soccer.
Get. Yeah. It was hard for you to get out that word 46. You weren't exactly. You had to think about it for a second. You had to think about it. So 46. You're playing soccer and you did a header. Is this when a young? So you still play soccer? Or is this a new sport for you? Sorry.
It's a community pickup, and most of the players are like high school, college. But there's a few of us that haven't figured
good
out.
Good for you. Good
yeah,
for you.
Yeah. Good for you.
Are you good?
My son thinks I am.
Ah,
well,
okay.
That's the highest praise.
Yeah, that's the highest praise. If your kid thinks you're good at soccer, obviously you're good at soccer. That's exactly it. Yeah, you may have done something to the back of the nose that caused some inflammation. So the answer is yes. So a steroid inhaler for a week or 2 weeks in the back of the nose may get it to settle down. And so your brain is interpreting that information as mint. Why it's happening, I don't know. But the brain does funny things, and our taste is through our nose, except for sweet, salty, sour, bitter, and fullness called umami. The rest of it is all through our nose. So, yeah, I'd use a steroid inhaler. By the way, this can happen with a variety of other injuries that occur. People who lose their sense of taste have some interesting maladies that occur because it could have been some trauma to the back of the tongue. I have a cousin who fell down, hit the back of her head, so she's lost her sense of taste. And vodka tastes like sugar to her. So she has some very interesting interpretations. She has to be very careful of what she drinks at when she's at parties because she can't taste alcohol, which is sort of the back of her throat. Yeah, steroid inhaler and keep up the soccer games.
All right. Thank you.
Sure. Appreciate the call. Thank you. And before we head out, Zorba, time again to hear from your favorite crew, the Grammar Police.
Oh, I love them.
But I've got to say, I'm not sure that this is a fair issue to take with you. You'll understand.
So wait a second. So you're policing, let me get it right, policing the grammar police.
My sense of your grammar doesn't jibe with David's, who takes issue with your pronunciation.
No. Pronunciate it correctly with my pronunciation.
I'm going to hear from a listener. of a certain town in Massachusetts, he writes, Tom and Zorba, I love listening to your show. It's very informative. However, I feel the need to correct one thing. On several occasions, you have mentioned the famous long-term heart study known as the Framingham Heart Study. However, you are not pronouncing the name of my hometown correctly. It is an easy mistake to make, as most of the cities and towns in Massachusetts do have the old English pronunciation. But Framingham is pronounced framing, as in one framing a picture, and ham, as in a Virginia ham. I know you meant no disrespect and will be happy to correct your pronunciation. Keep up the good work. Don't you say Framingham?
Who knows what I say? Now I hear about it. You think I know what I say? Come on, it comes out of my mouth. However, I have an analogous issue. I am from Chicago.
Yeah.
Now, people outside of Chicago say Chicago. That is not the way we in Chicago pronounce it. We pronounce it Chicago, which is more of an aw sound versus an ah sound. And whenever I hear somebody say Chicago, I know they're not from Chicago.
Yeah, that's interesting. Say, I've never heard that.
And now for me, I immediately know that they're a non-person. So, you know, a persona non grata.
Well, say the name of Chicago.
Framingham. It's Framingham or Framingham.
Framingham?
I think I say Framingham. And you know what? Because I take umbrage. It's a disrespect to a Chicagoan to say it's a Chicagoan.
Yeah.
I am now going to have, if I can remember in my name, Framingham instead of Framingham. So you know what?
Yeah.
They live in the city. They know the right way to pronounce it.
So thank you, David, in Massachusetts. And if you think Zorba has been hamming it up too much, send your grievances along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org or send it through Facebook.
And don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen, and our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leon Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping for your company on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1026Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at zorbapastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.